Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
New activation and upfront payment for 3-month plan required. Taxes and fees extra. Additional restrictions apply. See mintmobile.com for full terms.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Fantasy Writers Toolshed, a podcast dedicated to all things writing with a focus on the fantasy genre. My name is Richie Billing, and I've got a cracking and varied lineup in store for you today. We're kicking things off with a look at science in fantasy with author, neuroscientist and mushroom lover, Rachel Emma Shaw. So definitely one if you love a bit of world building. After that, we've got a bunch of interesting calls for submissions for you. And then we'll be looking at all things archery with our resident historian, Aidan Mattis. Then we're got a few community shout-outs for you then. Before we finish off with a look at Norse mythology with our folklorist Janina Arndt and Lucy Atkinson. Before we dive in, if you haven't already done so, it would mean an awful lot if you followed or subscribed to the show, if you gave it a quick review or shared it with anyone you think may be interested. It's very much a community-driven podcast, so any support you can give means the world. We also have a Patreon page now where you can pledge your allegiance and get some really cool things in the process. So you can get a copy of a Fantasy Writer's Handbook, and you can get access to all my fantasy writing courses as well. If you ever have any questions, comments or cases for me, please email in at thefantasywriterstoolshed@gmail.com. And if you haven't already done so, join our community of writers. We have a Discord server and a Facebook group, and hundreds of writers congregate there. Only last week, someone had a short story published after someone else in the group had helped them with it. So connections, it's what it's all about. So to join, just click the link in the description and we'll be chatting with us all before you know it. Lastly, if you like super helpful newsletters, check out the Writer's Toolshed, not the Fantasy Writer's Toolshed, but the Writer's Toolshed, which is a bi-weekly newsletter for writers. It goes out on the 14th and 28th of each month. Usually it contains a link to listen to this podcast. So if you ever want to keep abreast with episodes, this is the way to do it. As well as a link to the podcast, it's packed with free and useful downloads, writing tips, news, calls for submissions. And you can also take advantage of my community shout-outs. So that goes out to about 4,000 people. So if you want some free promotion, join us and send me a quick email. Anyway, let's crack on and dive into a bit of science-based world building. Hello and welcome to a part of the show focused all on world building. And we'll be looking at all different aspects of building a fantasy world to help inspire you and to give you the tools to essentially conquer this beast of a job. And today we're going to cover a topic that I don't think gets the attention it deserves, and that is science in fantasy. Now, when we think of the fantasy genre, we don't instantly relate it to science. Probably we stray more towards magic, and it's a fantasy anyway. So if there's a flaw in our scientific knowledge, then we just can just shrug and just say, well, it's a fantasy, so don't worry about it. But there are many elements of a fantasy world that do require some scientific thought. And I'm not a scientist whatsoever, but I know someone who is. And that is neuroscientist and fantasy author Rachel Emma Shaw. Rachel, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on, Richie.
Oh, thanks for joining me. I've met Rachel a few weeks ago at FantasyCon. And she is the author of Last Memoria, which I believe was an SPFBO finalist in 2020. Is that right?
Yeah, you got it.
Oh, I always get that abbreviation wrong all the time.
Well, at least you can say SPFBO. We have this argument in the community whether it's SPFBO and SPFBO, and oh, the second one just makes me cringe.
SPFBO.
Oh, don't say it. Yeah.
So Rachel also has a brilliant YouTube channel called Science in Fantasy, and she'll be joining us for a few episodes to discuss the influence of science on the fantasy genre, particularly when it comes to world building. So we'll be looking at magic systems and evolution. But today we're going to have a look at the general influence that, or the role that science plays when it comes to building fantasy worlds and fantasy writing as a whole. Rachel, why don't you tell us a bit about it and the influence it has?
I mean, where to start? Actually, I know exactly where to start. We'll start at the very beginnings of fantasy. You know, that was times of folklore writing. And then, you know, skip forward a few hundred years, you get on to more Tolkien's era. But Tolkien brought forward his, you know, love of history into this genre that has very much been shaped by him. And I feel like we've always been playing catch up with the science ever since, because it's almost like there are lots of people who have a passion for science now who are starting to recognize that there is a space for science in fantasy. And so it's only been in more recent times that we're starting to see them bring their passion in whatever format it is, whether it's, you know, archaeology or, you know, biology like me. It's fantastic to see authors starting to think about how we can use science to change what the shape of the fantasy genre is.
Yeah, it's amazing. Like you say, archaeology there, that's something that I explored with a recent story of mine, just because I like watching Time Team.
There you go. It's all about the passion. And I think that's exactly why we're seeing more science coming through, because science is becoming more mainstream in general. I think as the years progress, each generation is becoming more science literate. So we're just seeing a higher caliber of science being integrated into general society. And then that's just seeping into fantasy, which is amazing.
Yeah, definitely. And I think what I love to see as well is there are a lot of scientific problems facing humanity at the moment, like climate crisis and things like that. So it's great to see that people are engaging with scientific things and writing about them and including them in the stories, because that's how they share the knowledge and the insights with other people, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think we're seeing almost a science activism in not all, like fantasy, it's a bit of a tough nut in that sense. We have some readers who are like, just stop. I go into fantasy to escape. I don't want your climate change messaging there, which is completely viable. You know, if you are looking for escapism, you want that in your book. You do not want to be feeling guilty about air pollution. But then you have some others who are using fantasy as the tool it can be to explore all of these concepts in a way that is allowing us to hold a mirror up to our society, but delve deeper into an issue because we're not accusing anyone. We're looking at the implications without it saying that, well, this country is at fault or this is the reason why this is happening. Instead, you're just saying, let's explore what the consequences of this will be and raise awareness about it in that way. And I think that's really damn cool.
Yeah.
Can I not swear? Yeah.
No, that's fine. There's been a lot worse on this podcast. But yeah, like you say, it's like science fiction exploring like ways of saving humanity or sort of exploring theories of populating other planets and stuff like that. Like science, that's why I like fantasy, because there's sort of like a philosophical element to it that you can sort of really dig deep into, like the human nature really. But like the scientific side of things as well is one that doesn't get credit it deserves, but also the use it deserves as well, because like you say, there are a lot of pertinent issues science-wise in our lives at the moment, and we can really explore them more in fiction, can't we? And especially in fantasy, where anything's possible.
You know, it's funny you should bring up science fiction, because, you know, we've seen science used, obviously, in science fiction a lot in the past, and it's almost as if people thought, if you're going to use science in your fiction works like that, it has to be in science fiction. And no, leave fantasy for the dragon and, you know, the wizards. And this is why, you know, in sci-fi, we've seen authors like Ursula Le Guin. She, you know, she wasn't an anthropologist herself, but her parents were. And a lot of her stories had that analysis of behavior in that sense that came from the passion that she was brought up with. And that was almost commonplace in sci-fi for so long. And yet we just haven't seen similar in fantasy until in more recent years, I think.
Why do you think it's important for writers to consider sciences like biology and physics and things like that when they're writing and designing the sort of these worlds?
So many reasons. I'm going to stick with okay, there's reasons like why it's good for, in general, the fantasy genre and for readers out there. But let's cut to the heart of this and say why it is good for you as the author to do this. And that's because it's a fantastic tool for making your world seem more unique. Now, we've all seen Tolkien-esque lookalikes. And like I said, if you're just writing to a niche of people who just want more books that are like a book that they've already read, then by all means, you know, those ones, there's a place for those books. But if you're the kind of author who wants to create something that is different, that has a different feel to it, that you can stamp your badge on and say, this was mine, then using science is a fantastic way to do that, because there's so many avenues of science that have been unexplored over the years. So yeah, that's the selfish reason why you should do it.
No, I totally agree, because it is, it's becoming harder and harder, isn't it, to find unique and original angles. And the science sort of strand hasn't really been explored enough. So there's loads you can do, really, isn't there?
I just can't champion it enough. So in SPFBO, when I was getting the reviews back in the final stage from all the blogs and that involved, I was amazed to see one common thread come in. You know, whether or not they liked the story or they got the characters, the one thing all of the blog teams agreed on was they said, it is so unique. There was someone who said it was probably the most unique fantasy book he'd read in years. And the reason for that was the concept of Last Memoria is about memory thieves. It's about the consequences for identity of losing memories. I was tackling concepts like dementia, but instead of doing it in the real world, where dementia is a very triggering thing to talk about, you know, asking someone to consider whether their grandfather is still their grandfather when their grandfather has dementia and doesn't have their memories anymore is quite a heartbreaking thing to think about. But if you do it in a fantasy setting with a memory thief who can take memories, can create new memories, you're asking questions of identity there. It allows people to explore the concept of identity in a new way, with a new lens. And it was entirely my neuroscience background that led me to create that kind of story.
Yeah, sounds amazing. I'm going to have to go and check that out now.
Yay, new reader. No.
Yeah, so how did you find that process then, like being so focused? Like, I'm guessing you've had to have a good understanding because you've got that science background, haven't you? So tell us about your process then of design and that sort of system.
Oh, for designing the memory thieves, actually, there's a better way of doing this, because the memory magic, that was, there's a level in there where you say, okay, well, magic has to take over at this point. You know, science cannot explain that. But there was a concept with the memory magic that had a lot of science base to it. And this was that the people who could steal memories, it wasn't just the memories of people that they could access, also creatures. Also, that meant that, you know, that one of the characters, she could be, she could touch someone else, and she could touch a horse, and she could like calm the horse down because she'd like take away any bad memories that were making it fretful. But she could also do this when it came to plants. Now, plants don't exactly have, they don't have memories, not in the sense that we do, but what they have is the ability to, you know, sense the environment around them like we can, and then retain information about the environment around them and even learn from the environment around them. So they do this thing called habituation, some plants, where they have a response that where their leaves curl up if something touches them. And then if you touch them too much, then you see that they stop curling because they've habituated to the sensation of touch. So that's retaining some sort of memory storage. So I use this in the world. And I had a race of people, the memory thieves, who could alter the ability of the plants to kind of remember, if you will, these senses. So you could trick them into thinking that sunlight was coming from a different direction. And that meant that they lived underground, so they could access the plant, and they could trick the plant to also, as well as growing above ground, to also grow below ground, which means that they could get the plant to grow fruits underground so that they didn't have to go up to the surface to forage from these. And so that's how science inspired me to come up with cool uses for the magic.
Yeah, that's amazing, though. I've never heard anything like that. It's really, like you say, unique.
There you go. I think bonkers is another word for it. But
so what point in the process then of building your world did you decide, or the scientific considerations, like what point did you consider them, Or honestly, did that sort of, did you build it around that at the beginning, or did it sort of that just developed as the story unfolded?
You know, I never actually thought about it. It wasn't until about 3 months ago when the idea for my YouTube channel hit me that I actually realized what I'd been doing in my writing that was making it so different. Yeah. It's bizarrely enough, it was only then when I've been thinking, I know I'm doing something odd. I don't know what it is. And I know that whatever I'm doing that is odd would be a great thing to share with others in some media format. But I just had no idea what it was. And then I was talking to a friend as we were walking around my favorite local forest. And it hit me as I was talking to him that I was combining science and fantasy, and that would be a fantastic angle to make a YouTube channel about. And so, yeah, it was a very natural process for me that just came out of something that I loved. But that doesn't mean that if you're a non-scientist that you can't do it also, because it's your passion. You're just putting what you're passionate about into your story. So, you know, whether you're interested in geology like N.K. Jemisin, or you're interested in, I don't know, the evolution of creatures, you know, you're obsessed with insects, or in my case, I have this weird fascination with fungi, and the next book has a huge fungal element to the story where I've got thousands of different species. So it's just about putting your passion into the story and not being afraid to let that make your world crazy.
Yeah, that sounds great. I like the fungi idea, because I really like the idea of fluorescent fungi.
Yes. So yeah,
cool.
They are incredible. There's Saqqara, the book's called Saqqara Nights. And in Saqqara, the world is in total darkness because it's situated in a canyon next to a volcano. And there's an updraft from the canyon that means the ash that spews out of the volcano just is kind of like a thick cloud above the city. So the sunlight never gets through. Yeah. The ash sometimes falls when it rains, which means that the city is covered in ash a lot. And that's a fantastic environment for these fungi to thrive in the darkness and on the ashy soil, which is just filled with nutrients. And so because it's darkness, there are no trees that grow. So because there's no trees, there's light is difficult down there. And they cultivate these fluorescent fungi that basically shed this blue glow across the streets, which makes it a very, it feels eerie, and it feels so distinct because that one little thing.
Really cool. Yeah, I remember the sort of the ash clouds, but only from like Mistborn, where the sort of the mist would come out at night. But that wasn't really ash, was it? I can't remember if it was anything to do with a volcano.
No, wasn't that?
I'm that confused.
Oh God, that's so long ago since I read that.
No.
Oh, more time for reading.
So, when you're considering world building, then how many elements do you think relate to science? Like we met, didn't we, sort of for the damage panel in FantasyCon, and we were talking about science there, because in terms of if someone gets wounded, what sort of medical equipment or medical knowledge is available to help that person recover? So that's to do with science as well, and so it affects loads of different strands of the world building process. Are there any sort of key ones that you think that writers should be mindful of?
Most authors probably have seen this, but there's advice from Brandon Sampson, which is about these are all these different ways that you can world build for your story. Don't do all, because that's too many. It makes the world a little dense. And don't do too few, because then people think you've not done enough world building. But a lot of those concepts that he has, they avoid the science side. And I know why. It's because he's pulled those together off years of experience reading the fantasy genre, which was all in the style, not all, but like a lot of it was built on the style of Tolkien. So it was following that same pattern. So there are some fantastic sciencey angles that you can implement in that sense. You know, an understanding of the evolution of your species is a fantastic one to do that. You know, how did your species get to where it is? Can you map back other species that are similar, that maybe evolved in other niches in nearby parts of the world? Other things you can do, thinking about the other fantasy races that live nearby and how they behave. Do they hibernate? Do they, what do they eat? What do they consume? What are their behavioral patterns? You don't have to do it for too many. I'm not suggesting that there are millions of different species in our world. I'm not saying you should create millions of species for your fantasy world. That would get a little insane. But think about different niches. So, you know, we have horses, and all too often in fantasy, we use horses because they are a simple solution. But actually, could something else have evolved? You know, perhaps a flight means rather than a horse means land traveling. Other things, I love healing as a subject when it comes to fantasy. I think understanding, you know, I did a video on YouTube on childbirth and fantasy and magic, and about how it boggles my mind how few fantasy books actually have a magic system that would help childbirth. And I did a Reddit post about it, and loads of people commented on the Reddit post, but they all did about like maybe pregnancy and stuff, but no one, like, in fact, very few managed to find a book that had a magic system where the magic was being used to make childbirth easier. Now, when you consider that childbirth was such a problem for so many, so look, and not just the women, you know, the husband was like losing their wife, you know, it's a horrendous thing. You know, the children were dying, the mothers were dying. It was just traumatic. And yet we have people with these fantastic magics, and no one would have thought at some point, how can I apply this to one of the biggest problems that we have here? Yeah. You know, it's a logical step that they would have made, unless they are a society that is really heartless and they do not care for some reason. So it's thinking about those kind of implications.
It's amazing. We could go on for ages, couldn't we? Chatting about all the different strands. But we will in the next few episodes focus on some of the other bigger ones. And next time around, we're going to look at magic systems and science, because for me, it seems like a bit of a contradiction of them two things, or at least there's a conflict between them. Rachel's got some brilliant points that we're going to discuss in the next episode. So, Rachel, thanks very much for joining us today. How can we find out more about you and your writing?
Oof, I guess the YouTube would probably be the best place to start. It's just called Science and Fantasy. Search my name, Rachel Emmershaw. That's my author name. So, also my actual name. I don't know why I said it like it wasn't the same. I couldn't do a pen name. I just couldn't lie about it. I forget. So yeah, if you want to find me, I've got my books, Last Memoria, Scars of Cereba, and Sakara Knight.
Thanks very much again, and thanks for listening.
Thanks for having me.
A big thank you to Rachel for sharing her scientific wisdom there. Rachel will be joining me again in upcoming episodes for more science-based well-building chats. But now it's time for some calls for submissions, and we've got a few interesting ones this episode. Black Hair Press is currently looking for dark speculative short fiction or weird horror. Head to blackhairpress.com to find out more about that one. Synthetic Reality Magazine is looking for science fiction, fantasy, slipstream, horror, sword and sorcery, and surreal fiction stories up to 5,000 words. Just head over to syntheticrealitymagazine.com. You can find the submission guidelines on there as well. DMR Books has recently reopened for submissions for a themed anthology, which is tentatively entitled Samhain Sorceries. The concept for this book will be sword and sorcery, where Samhain / Halloween is a big part of the plot. They're looking for stories between 4,000 and 8,000 words there. Steliform Press is looking for novels with a focus on climate issues, which I really like the sound of. I think that's very important though. Novellas, novels, short story collections are what they're looking for, and they do pay advances and royalties. So just head over to steliform.press to find out more there. And new publisher Muddy Paw Press is looking for short stories up to 5,000 words, as well as novels. Just head over to muddypawpress.org and find their submission guidelines. Good luck if you do submit. If you find success, please drop me an email to let me know so that we can celebrate. And we're going to dive right into our next part now. And once again, we're drifting back to the medieval period for an in-depth look at archery with medieval historian Aidan Mattis. Hello and welcome to another dose of medieval history with our resident historian, Aidan Mattis, from the fantastic Law Lodge podcast. How's it going today, Aidan?
Good.
Very good. So last time we spoke about diseases of the Middle Ages, didn't we? And the general way of life that contributed to the development and spreading of diseases. And that I found it fascinating, and it's hopefully you've out there enjoyed it for the sort of world-building inspiration and ideas. And we're going to carry on that train today. And I wanted to ask you about archery in the medieval era because I think it is often misportrayed as...
A little bit.
Just a little bit. Yeah.
A little bit.
So why don't you take it away?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, archery, obviously, as a method of warfare dates back, a couple thousand years. You get biblical accounts of archery. You get Mycenaean, Greek, and Egyptian accounts of archers being involved in battles. But the Middle Ages is, I'd say, the period that is most commonly associated with archery. And it's simply because I think it is this period during which archers are most portrayed in actual art and in literature. And you get, obviously, the tale of Robin Hood from around 15th century England, which comes from a poem about this character, Robin of Locksley, who's an English yeoman. And the way it kind of made its way into modern literature and modern fantasy writing is very much through Lord of the Rings, through Tolkien. And, he's got archery is a central concept of Lord of the Rings. But the archery practiced in Lord of the Rings, in many cases, is very much this ranger type archery, where you've got this highly skilled marksman who's very much a Robin Hood kind of character, very skilled with a bow, who lurks through the forest and ambushes people. And that's where the Rangers of Athelion and all that come from. And while there were certainly archers who were that capable with a bow, who could draw a, full length yew longbow and hit somebody, dead in the forehead at 100 yards, that existed, but it certainly was not common. And much more often you'd get, for example, just to keep on since we're talking about fantasy, to keep on the Lord of the Rings path, what you see in the Peter Jackson adaptation, if you see the Battle of Helm's Deep, the archers just firing off mass volleys from the walls and tons of arrows bouncing off of plate armor, and it basically being nothing but a slight impediment to the enemy advance. That is what medieval archery was for the most part. And the average bow used by the Nordic peoples, by the Vikings, by the Normans, by the French, the Germans, the bows they were using up until they adopted the crossbow. And in some cases, like the Vikings did not ever adopt a crossbow. It just wasn't a practical weapon because the Viking method of warfare was based around these very fast, amphibious invasions. And taking the enemy by surprise. Vikings didn't like to lay siege. And they fought in shield wall formations for the most part. And that's why the Viking Age kind of dies out after 1066, is because the mounted knight took precedence. And that's just not how the Vikings fought. You couldn't take a horse on a longboat. It just wasn't going to work for you. But so most of the bows used throughout European history were, 30 to 60 pound draw weight, would definitely be enough they were mostly just basically hunting bows. And they would be enough to take down a completely unarmored deer, but by no means were you going to be, penetrating chainmail and plate mail with that. You could even possibly not penetrate, at enough distance. If you were at even the slightest angle, it would bounce off of leather and just leave a little scratch mark. Even swords could be stopped by a gambeson, which was just, 5-6 layers of linen stacked on top of each other, or wool. So these, when you see medieval battles portrayed in fantasy literature and fantasy movies, there's often, just these, people shooting arrows and it goes, straight through plate mail and kills somebody. And that's just not what would happen. If you had a very skilled Welsh longbowman who had been practicing with this thing, and often they came from the marches, so that border between Wales and England, because that was where most of the warfare was happening. And that was where you essentially were having people recruited from by the English and the Welsh. So one of them who was practicing using, a 150 pound draw weight yew longbow at less than 100 yards, less than 100 meters, that person probably could shoot an armored knight and kill them by penetrating their armor in a weak point, but it wasn't going to be, you know, it just wasn't efficient in medieval warfare to use that kind of tactic.
Yeah.
And of course, ambush tactics, hit and run tactics existed. And, you know, that's where a lot of this comes from, is that Robin Hood type story, that legend of, you know, the yeoman out in the woods with his band of thieves who are all very skilled marksmen and all that. But if you were actually looking at a pitched medieval battle, for example, Agincourt, what the English were doing is they recruited this massive army of peasant longbowmen and pikemen. The pikemen primarily being from the north and the longbowmen primarily being from the west, from Wales and the marches. And there were, at that point, the English had seen the utility of the longbow and they were starting to train their own longbowmen from a younger age. But it was still predominantly the Welsh marches that were supplying these men to the English army. And at Agincourt, what happened was the mud made it so that the French knights couldn't really move that efficiently, and they lined up their pikemen to create a barrier, sat their archers back, and just would unleash volley after volley of hundreds, if not thousands, of arrows from these very, very strong yew longbows that were about 6 feet long. That's taller than me. You got to remember the average height of a medieval person was, you know, 5'6", 5'7". And they were using these 6 foot long bows that were, again, I don't think people quite realize this, 150 pounds draw weight means you're launching that thing a quarter of a mile.
Yeah.
That arrow is going a quarter of a mile. That is like, guns do that.
Yeah.
So that's the maximum efficient, that's the maximum effective range of like an AK-47.
Yeah. That's insane. So
yeah.
I always remember the Battle of Cressy. Because
yes,
similar in terms of,
it's just so funny. It's such a funny story.
Yeah, because that was similar, because it was more of a tactical advantage, and he couldn't get up the hill.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the French couldn't get up the hill at the English, and he just basically unloaded on them. Is that what happened?
Yeah, I mean it's very similar to what happened to Hastings as well. You had the English sitting up on a hill with their pikemen out front, and they would have their archers also drive stakes into the ground in front of them. So they didn't even really always need their pikemen. They already had their stakes, which would get you probably an extra volley during a mounted charge, you know, the extra seconds it would buy you. But they basically just sat their archers on a hill. And as the French charged, they just would launch volley after volley of these very, very powerful bows, shooting rather an arrow for a longbow. You're looking at about, you know, this long, you know, a couple of feet with a very heavy, you know, steel broadhead for combat. You know, these were, it was brutal. And for a long time, the English actually employed mixed armies of longbowmen and musketeers. Until it became much cheaper to use muskets. But yeah, a longbow might not penetrate, you know, full plate armor with, you know, chainmail in the joints and leather underneath. Like a fully armored mounted knight, if they got hit right in the breastplate, probably going to be okay. Might knock the wind out of them, but
yeah.
Longbow arrow probably not going to penetrate it. Crossbow, on the other hand, will. But a longbow isn't going to do that. But you got to remember, the vast majority of soldiers fighting these wars were not wearing high quality plate armor. They were wearing leather, they were wearing gambesons, they were wearing chainmail, and a longbow would absolutely, if it got you at the right angle, penetrate chainmail. And within 100 yards, this is like getting shot with a gun. And the other thing that would happen is, and the reason the English were so effective, and the reason that the longbow became this mythical weapon that's so commonly used in fantasy literature, is because it was accurate, it was powerful, and it was just like more reliable. You could hit somebody at a range that there was no possible way they could hit you. So the English had this advantage with their armies where, even going up against other well-equipped, well-trained, well-funded armies, they were going to be able to get off, you know, even in an army of like a French army, like that would be primarily on horseback, they'd be able to get off 4 or 5 volleys by the before the French would even hit their lines. And you got to remember also, you know, the knights themselves were armored, but the horses weren't.
Yeah.
And they might be lightly armored with like cloth and leather, but you weren't going to have a horse riding around in plate mail. That's something that's been completely fabricated that, you know, that would happen. That was like for jousting. This thing is a lot of the sets of armor that we have that survived from the Middle Ages are joust, are tournament sets. So for a long time, people were like, oh, that's what combat armor looked like, but that's probably not true.
Yeah.
But yeah, so the English had this advantage where, you know, they could start hitting your army while you were a quarter mile away from them. And then what are you going to do about that? But this was the primary method of archery warfare was the second you thought you could hit them, you were just launching volleys at their infantry as they approached. And the Vikings would do this. They would do this from their ships. They would do this from behind their infantry lines. They would just get lots and lots of these very relatively weak bows. But it's a lot harder to advance if you have a shower of arrows coming down on top of you. And the Vikings actually used the longbow used the bow as suppressive artillery very effectively. We have lots of accounts of the Vikings, you know, landing a force and then, you know, putting some archers behind their line and just launching arrows to keep the enemy's head down. Whereas the French and the Germans took a bit more of a, they used the crossbow very extensively. And that was a weapon that obviously took a lot more time to reload. So you're going to aim your shots a little bit more. But against an army that their bows outranged yours, that just wasn't an option. And there's the example of Crecy, for example, where you had the French send up their Genovese crossbow mercenaries. These were arguably some of the best crossbowmen in the world.
Yeah.
And they couldn't get to firing range because they were just getting torn up. They were just getting turned into Swiss cheese by all of these longbow arrows that were just raining down on them. And even when they would turn around to put they had those big pavis shields on their back. Yeah. Even when they would turn around to reload and have that shield that was supposed to protect them from arrow fire, the longbows would penetrate those shields. So it was just this crazy powerful weapon that only really faded out of popularity because it was much cheaper and it took a lot less time. And that was really what it was the time that it took to train a longbowman. It took 15, 20 years to get somebody to the point where they're going to be effective in battle as a longbowman. You could train somebody to use a musket and fire in a volley in 2 weeks. So that's why musket warfare took over for as long as it did. And that's why as time has gone on, we've seen the evolution of, you know, we use snipers a lot in modern combat, but obviously not everyone we employ in the field today can be a sniper because it takes years to train to that level of skill with a rifle. And with a longbow, it was the same thing. It took a lifetime of learning. And that's why, that's one of the reasons why in Tolkien's work, in even like John Flanagan, The Ranger's Apprentice, even in that work, you're looking at very small numbers of people who have this very high skill level with a bow.
Yeah.
And it's very cool what they've done with fantasy literature and with fantasy film and media, where you have these examples of all of these, you know, super talented archers having, you know, their ambuscades set up and all that. But that was not the majority way that this was fought. That was the very rare exception to the rule of using it as the same as basically suppressive machine gun fire is used today.
Yeah, it's fascinating. One thing I wanted to ask you about as well, I did a bit of archery a couple of years ago now with a guy who used to shoot for Great Britain in the young sort of Olympic team. And he taught me so much about it. So like the armor that you wear and things like that. One thing that stuck in my mind is the quiver and the position of the quiver. Because everybody has, in fantasy, the quiver on the shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
Or if it's on the sort of hip, you've got them pointing the wrong way. So you've got them putting back behind you. So when you come to get an arrow, you've got no arrows left in your quiver.
It's totally messed up. it's likely that, you know, quivers obviously were a real thing. They were used, but they were probably used more in hunting. So, and because it's going to be very hard to run with a quiver because your arrows are going to be whether it's on your back or on your hip. When you would get into combat, you would literally, you would have either a, basically a box that you would set on the ground that you would throw all your arrows in, or more commonly, you would just take your, you know, two dozen arrows you brought with you and just shove them point first into the ground so that you could just grab them really quick and knock them straight to your bow. You know, it's really cool when you see Robin Hood, you know, lean back and whoever's playing him at the time and just like knock an arrow and, you know, 500 yards into the eye of some, you know, armored knight through his like slit in his visor. But that, that just wasn't what happened. Quivers definitely existed, definitely used, but probably not in combat, especially in the set piece fighting of the high and late Middle Ages. Now, if you're looking at like the Viking Age, that's where you would see a quiver used more in the way it's portrayed in fantasy literature and media, is, you know, this, this mobile kind of thing. But it certainly wouldn't be facing, you know, back away from you, because then you're just going to lose your arrows. They were also used for horseback very commonly if you were shooting from horseback. But even then, a lot of the times you would have your quivers mounted up on the shoulders of the horse or on its flanks next to you, just straight up to prevent any of the arrows from falling out. But yeah, it's the whole idea of the way quivers are portrayed and used in film media, it looks really cool. And it, you know, it creates a very like cool picture in our heads when we read it, but it's not even remotely accurate to how the battles were fought.
Yeah. It's all about speed, isn't it? In the battle.
Yeah. So exactly. You don't want to be, you know, wrestling with your quiver and, you know, then it's, you know, slinking down your back and you can't quite reach. You gotta be like, you know, oi Jimmy, you know, can you fix my, no, you're just, you want to be able to just reach down, grab the arrow, knock it, pull, aim, fire. And there are, for example, in The Battle for Scandia, which is, I think, the fourth book of the Ranger's Apprentice series, which is one of my favorite fantasy series of all time. It's written for younger people, and I read it when I was a kid. But they still hold up, honestly, going back and reading them. They just have much, you know, much simpler themes. So, but there's a very vivid scene in that where Will, who's a ranger's apprentice, he's this younger version. Essentially, if you think of the Dunedain Rangers from Lord of the Rings, that's basically what John Flanagan was doing, but with this kind of different, more politicized system where they're kind of like a sheriff almost. But there's this scene where Will has trained a whole bunch of Scandian fighters, who are obviously a society based off of Vikings, and then he's trained them against what appears to be a society based off of the Mongols. And he's got them, you know, one guy will hold up a shield while the other reloads his bow. And it's just very simple. They've got the arrows out in front of them in a box. They grab the arrow, they knock it, they aim at a certain angle, fire, shield goes back up, they repeat. And that's, you know, obviously without the shields, but that's what it would look like in a medieval battle. So at Cressy, at Agincourt, that's probably what happened, was they had these lines of longbowmen sitting there, you know, would go off with a volley within 10 seconds, 15 seconds. They're ready to go. They shoot again. And when you think about how long it takes to cross, you know, 400 yards on foot, or at Cressy, you know, that would have been on horseback, but up a hill. So 400 yards on horseback, up a hill, it's going to take you 20, 30 seconds.
Yeah.
And then you got to convince the horse to charge through pikes and stakes. So that's it. You're getting 3-4 volleys off probably. And then at Poitiers, where the French king decided that the horses were traitors and had his knights charge a mile in 96 degree heat in full armor, you know, try to run 400 yards in full medieval plate armor, and you've got people shooting at you like it's just not going to work out for you. You know, those three battles, Cressy, Poitiers, and Agincourt, are just, they are the fascinating example of why the longbow was the powerhouse that it was in the medieval period. But you also have to look at the way it was being used, because that's one thing that was very important. And for example, to use an example of the English getting beaten by the longbow, trying to remember the specific location of the battle. It was during the Glendower Rising, and it was Owen Glendower versus Edmund Mortimer. And Mortimer's army was larger than Glendower's and had more cavalry and everything. And what Owen did was he set his guys up on a hill. And it's going to come to me the second we get off of this. I'm going to remember the name of the battle. I think it was in 1402. They're up at the top of the hill, and he's got his infantry out in front. He's got his longbowmen further up the hill. And Mortimer's force is made up of similar forces, but larger in number. So he's got his infantry moving up the hill into longbow fire. And obviously that's slowing them down. He's got his own longbowmen down at the bottom of the hill, shooting up at the Welsh, but mostly missing. They couldn't quite, the Welsh had more range because of being on the hill. Yeah. So the longbowmen on Mortimer's side couldn't get close enough without being in the line of fire themselves. So as Mortimer's footmen inched their way up the hill, Owen had taken the opportunity before the battle to send some of his own men into the English ranks as longbowmen to convince the Welsh soldiers fighting for the English army to turn against the English during the battle. And then Mortimer's footmen, while they were on the hill, ended up getting shot at from both sides. And then Owen's light cavalry came in from the sides where they had been hiding off in a gully to finish the job. So basically, the only people to use the longbow more efficiently than the English were the people they were taking the weapon from, which makes sense. But it also, a lot of people have posed the question, why did the English have so much success when they invaded when they colonized the Americas? Given the guerrilla tactics used by the Native Americans, how did they manage to beat that when so many other European nations failed? Why, the French had to ally with the Native Americans. The British conquered. And to a large extent, you could probably wager that it's that they had this long breadth of experience of, stories of fighting the Welsh in these forests and on these mountainsides where the Welsh were just like popping out from behind rocks and shooting at them with longbows. So the English were used to it, and they used it greatly to their advantage in their colonization efforts.
Yeah, it's amazing. Aidan, that's been fascinating talking again. And like you've dispelled a lot of the myths, I think, that haunts fantasy.
It's got a lot of myths, and I've always found it weird because the truth is just as cool.
Yeah. So I hope you've learned something new there, chaps, because I have, again, learned something new as well. Aidan, it's been a pleasure having you back on.
Thank you.
Where can we find you?
You can find me on YouTube and Instagram at The Lore Lodge, and on pretty much everything else at The Aidan Mattis.
Fantastic. And we'll be back next week with a look at medieval life, which, again, is something that is often misrepresented in fantasy. until next time, see you later. Thank you again to Aidan for debunking the many myths surrounding archery. I hope you found that useful. I know I certainly did. Aidan will be back next episode with a look at day-to-day life in the medieval period, which is something that I think often gets overlooked in the world-building research process. So I'm hoping that you're going to find that very useful. Now it's time for our community shout-outs, and there are quite a few this time round. You've all been very, very busy, and I just want to say a massive congratulations to everybody. There's been some fantastic news coming into me this week, and it's been really nice to hear everyone doing so well. First of all, congratulations to Paul Levinson, who's had his short story Communication accepted for an upcoming anthology. Joan Ramirez has recently published a short story called Dignity in the 2021 MWSA anthology entitled Untold Stories. And this is a tribute to Vietnam War veterans. You can get the anthology on Amazon.com. Marie Law has a new rom-com out called Love and Pollination, which is available on Amazon. And it's also going on a blog tour from the 22nd of November, so keep an eye out for that. John Tarrow has a new book out called Letters from the Labyrinth, which is the fantasy sequel in letters to the novel The Stranger's Guide to Taliesin, which came out not long ago. John has an amazing house, which he's built himself. Some very awesome fantasy elements to it. So check that out at www.tarrow.co.uk. That's TARROW. Kaylena Radcliffe. She has two books in publishing pipeline. Congratulations on that. And she's currently writing the next one during NaNoWriMo. But those aren't quite ready for a promo. So instead, she's included an article for me to share with you. It's called Chicken Soup for the Self-Motivated Soul. And it's all about self-care. I've had a check out of it and it's amazing. Josie Jones has a brand new SFF farce called Blazing Coffins. And this is the first in a series called The Monster Twins. And apparently this is the first plug to the world of the book. So congratulations, Josie. And please go and check that book out on Amazon. Alex Greenwood, who's been on this podcast in the past, very nice guy, is about to release book 8 in the beloved John Pilate Mysteries. Well, I always call it Pilate. I called it Pilate deliberately there, but I know it's actually Pilate. But me and Alex had a bit of a laugh about that. So yeah, book 8 in the John Pilate Mysteries. Pilate's Faith is the name of the book. And there's currently a giveaway on Goodreads, and you can also order on Amazon. A big congratulations to Lucy McLaren on the impending release of her YA fantasy, A Child's Awakening. And that's due for release in May 2022. Sounds strange saying 2022. Bit of a tongue twister as well, so I'm not looking forward to that in a few months. But pre-orders have recently gone live. You can head to Amazon, Barnes & Noble and all the rest to get your copy. A big congratulations to Sherry Beck on the release of her new book, I Am Journey, available on Amazon. And congratulations to John Roseman on the release of his novel, Dreamfarer, which is the first in a series. Check it out on Amazon. It does sound very intriguing indeed, that one. Alana Gomel, a new short fantasy novel, is coming out later this month with Gypsy Shadow Publishing, titled Black House. Congratulations there. A.L. Secord has a second book in the series called Of the Stars, which is a paranormal romance, and that's coming out on the 30th of November. Check that one out on Amazon. Jane Bigelow has a new book out called The Most Convenient Corpse, which is available on Amazon, and it crosses genre lines with elements of fantasy, alternate history, and suspense. Stephen M. Phillips, congratulations on a new book, The Beast, The Messenger and The King, which is a fantasy adventure. It came out this week on Amazon. And Stephen's also put together a really great post on his experience getting this book ready for release, which you can read on his site, stephenmphillipsauthor.com. John Milligan has just released a book of short stories called Sweet and Sour. Congratulations, John. You can get that one on Amazon. And Craig Deegan has a new series out called The Cracklock Saga, which is an urban fantasy series that bridges YA and adult markets. The two books in that series are Fae or Foe, and the second is The Lost and The Departed, both available on Amazon. Well done again to everybody. If you've got any writing news out there you want to share, please drop me an email at thefantasywriterstoolshed@gmail.com, and I will, of course, give it a plug on this podcast and also on my newsletter, The Writer's Toolshed. So you can find the links in the description. Now I think it's time for a bit of Norse mythology, which has grown exponentially in popularity of late. I absolutely love a bit of Norse mythology, and I've been very excited to bring this part of the show to you today. Delighted to welcome back once again Lucy Atkinson and Janina Arndt. Welcome to our folklore and mythology segment of the show. And I'm delighted to be joined again by Janina Arndt and Lucy Atkinson from the Fae Fellows podcast. How are you both today?
Oh, we're great. Lovely day today.
Yeah.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Very welcome to be here. So we're going to talk about Norse mythology today, because I don't know about you guys at home listening, but everything seems to be Norse this, Norse that. I think we've had a few big TV shows, haven't we, in the last few years. We've got Vikings. I love Vikings. I thought it was fantastic. And The Last Kingdom as well is another excellent one. And I think everything down to like the style, tattoos, everyone just seems to be embracing Norse mythology, the Nordic life. And I thought it would be, considering this is one of our first episodes sort of on this topic, it'd be a good one to tackle, because everyone just seems to be drawn to him. So what do you think, tell us a bit about Norse mythology and what is this sort of draw?
I guess the part of the draw, I think, comes from the fact that we spend so much time talking about Greek mythology and Roman mythology. And Norse mythology is one that for a while got kind of left to the curb and was only used in like vague references. And now I think we're getting much more into the that history that's been a little bit less explored. I think that's part of it.
Yeah.
You're not taught it at school so much. So most people discover that for themselves, and that's why they probably just enjoy it more, because they, you know, they conquer that for themselves, and then it's suddenly a thing they're interested in. Like, you know, people read the Marvel comics, people watch the films, and then they go, oh, where's that from? I don't think I've heard of this. And, you know, that's sort of what draws people into it.
Yeah. And what tell us about Norse mythology then. So got a very sort of sketchy knowledge of Norse mythology. I know a few of the sort of big hitter gods. But if you can sort of take us through a little bit of a tour on what it involves.
I mean, you know, to start off, you know, we should probably begin with Odin, who sacrificed himself to himself to gain ultimate wisdom, which is a very weird thing to consider.
Yeah.
But so he's the Allfather, who in Germanic myth is called Woden, which is where Wednesday comes from. That's where the D comes from that nobody pronounces. So yeah, I mean, you know, we've got the weekdays. I guess that's another big point of where we still come across them. And very much like in the Marvel, we've got Thor and Loki. They have a slightly different relationship in the original.
Yeah, they do. Yeah.
But yeah, so well, Thor is you know, the brawns of the operation, and Loki is very much the brain of a lot of it. But Loki is also the one who gets everyone into trouble. And Loki is Odin's blood brother in mythology. And he has monstrous children with giant wife, because he comes from the Frost Giants. And so these three monstrous children bring about Ragnarok in the end. So that's where the film very much went off the rails.
I don't know if they definitely bring around Ragnarok. They are involved in bringing around Ragnarok, but they don't do it on purpose.
Well, sort of. I mean, you know, they are very much abused by the gods throughout their lives, and they very much start out as good creatures, especially Fenrir the wolf is very kindly towards the gods and just says, I want my own freedom, and they don't give it to him. They trick him and bind him, and so he swears vengeance. Yeah. And so yeah, that's you know, one of the things that is so interesting about Norse mythology, because it is all very gory and all that, but you've got very distinct characters who all do some, you know, some very good things, but then on the other hand also can be very cruel, and they're very, you know, they're very round characters. And I think that's what resonates with us today very much, as opposed to, you know, some, not all, you know, there are rounded characters in Greek and Roman myth, but like there are quite a lot of stock figures there as well.
Yeah, I suppose.
And that seems
not what you expect from the Vikings, do you, really? Because everyone, well, as we're sort of taught about them in history, they're sort of portrayed as brutes that invade and kill and pillage, but yeah, they were quite cultural, weren't they? And they had a very close connection with the gods. So the storytelling side of it, I find so fascinating. I mean, we've touched upon there with Fenrir. And who were Fenrir's siblings?
Hel was his sister.
Yes.
What's the third one called?
Jormungandr, the Midgard.
I'm glad them. You said it, yes.
There you go.
Well pronounced.
The snake one, yes.
I'm not sure I pronounced that well. But yeah, the big snake, yes.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And then did you have the dwarves as well in Norse mythology, don't they?
Yeah.
Yes, yeah. Very much so. They are responsible for producing the hammer, Mjolnir, and other gifts to the gods, which are less famous.
Yeah. And so the Norse mythology then, it was very, obviously very important to Scandinavian people at the time. And it was very much at odds with the main religion of the era, wasn't it? It was Christianity. It hasn't really survived as Christianity has. So what do you think of the sort of the threat was to Norse mythology? Why didn't it survive? Whereas other ones, other sorts of belief systems did.
Yeah, I guess I think that's a thing with a lot of the pagan pantheons. We have to wonder why didn't they survive. In the case of the Norse mythology, it might be because they were more or less willing to conglomerate with other cultures and take other things in, maybe.
Yeah.
Or maybe because it is very surrounded by, it's kind of a warfaring culture, and when we weren't really doing war in that way anymore, maybe it doesn't have quite the same relevance.
Yeah.
I think it's a lot of it is also, you know, what the sources are that we have left, because, you know, like with the Celts and such, they were very much oral tales, and like, you know, the bard in that, you know, in that culture, both in, you know, in Icelandic culture and in, you know, in Celtic culture, it was very much a question of retelling the tales in a long narrative poem. And that's why they were poems as well, because you can remember rhyme better. So, you know, and a lot of that was lost, you know, always depending on who is the bigger, you know, invading force, really. But then how it kept being suppressed is also that a lot of creatures were put into folktales and then portrayed as, you know, as bad and horrific, like trolls, for example. Very, very interesting. So we think nowadays that they're like these horrible, stupid, ogre-like creatures. And that is, you know, that can very much be seen as, you know, as the people who stuck to their, you know, pagan beliefs being driven to the outside of society. There are lots of tales where where trolls are afraid of church bells and such like. And you can just see how that propaganda was very much put into folklore of the time to push these, you know, these different mythologies and to marginalize them, to make them evil and, you know, hateful to a new audience. And so that was very successful in that way of keeping that down and having people associate that with something that wasn't in any way identifiable, you know, to them, relatable in any way to them.
And if you especially think about it from like a writer's perspective, and if you're building a fantasy world and you want to have different belief systems, then just looking at how sort of different beliefs over time have ebbed and ebbed away, like it's amazing how you can, there's all that material there that you can apply to your own stories, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's difficult to put it in though, because like even with Norse mythology in particular, you've got the Prose Edda, which is much later than, like, you know, it's already in a time when everything was Christian, and Snorri Sturluson wrote that in a sort of renaissance of the original Nordic myths. But that is again very far removed from what the original might have been, so it's very hard to guess sometimes and to make it accurate. But I guess that just gives you freedom to put your own spin on it, really.
Yeah, definitely. We mentioned at the start about this new wave of interest in Norse mythology. So can you give us any examples of how it's been applied in more modern fantasy writing?
The kind of start of the new wave, I think, came in the Marvel films, as you mentioned earlier. And you get a lot of portrayals of Loki. Loki's the one that comes up the most.
Yes.
In a lot of books, Loki gets around. But the one that I think of is American Gods, Neil Gaiman's American Gods, and how that, I mean, that deals with a lot of different pantheons. But the Norse mythology comes through in that, sort of side by side with the Greek and Roman mythology and the other mythologies, which I think gives it its creams and kind of treats it as one of the big myths.
Yeah, he seems to love Norse mythology in particular, doesn't he, Neil Gaiman? Because he did a whole book on.
He did the whole retelling, which he starts by saying, "I got into this through the Marvel comics."
That's funny.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. And what about if we move away from the sort of the more mainstream ones, do you know of any good fantasy novels that have sort of Norse-inspired mythologies?
So there's a Norseman-inspired dragon in Narnia, which is not something that most people will remember because it's not in one of the more famous Narnia novels, but it's in The Dawn Treader. So, you know, for those of you who might remember Eustace, he does turn into a dragon at some point. That and that sort of sends him on a character journey, and that is really interesting because the man turned dragon is a very Norse idea. So there are a lot of tales of, for example, you know, Fafnir is turned into a dragon because of his greed for gold, right? And that's where we, you know, also, you know, the gold hoarding dragon is more of a Norse idea there. So yes, Smaug, it could be, you know, could be counted as an example of that. But so yeah, and the dragons of Norse mythology are very much, especially Fafnir, are very cunning as well, which is what we get the, you know, that sort of main feature in dragons from nowadays still. I just find that really interesting, the man dragon connection that isn't so much, that doesn't so much appear in other mythologies. Yeah, that does appear, and wherever you will find that in other modern fantasy, that is probably where it originated. People might not have actually read the myths, but they will probably have come across other adaptations that very much looked at these myths. Like C.S. Lewis definitely did research his mythologies, yeah. You know. So I find that really interesting how that perpetuates itself and now belongs in the image that we have of a certain creature.
Yeah. Because I Smaug, wasn't he, from The Hobbit? He was very cunning. I never appreciated that the sort of this archetype of dragons that look forward in gold that came from Norse mythology.
Yeah, and you know, it's connected to the dwarves again, who are also, you know, very prominent in Norse mythology.
Tolkien stealing from the past. Oh, it's not really stealing, is it? It's just adapting, but it just goes to show what you can really do with by looking at sort of these mythos and thinking of ways you still apply them to your own stories. It's amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. I've got a friend at university. Sorry. She wrote a whole, you know, like boarding school type fantasy series, the first of which deals with Ragnarok and modernity. So that was really interesting to read from her. She studied English with me, and she was also interested in it, like all sorts of mythologies crop up in her books, and in that instance we've got like other gods facing the Norse gods when Ragnarok happens, so that I thought was just really interesting. So that really was an inspiring, you know, creative process to watch.
Yeah. Anyone wants to go off and learn more about Norse mythology, have you got any material that you'd recommend checking out?
I think the Neil Gaiman book is pretty comprehensive, to be honest. Yeah. It's a pretty good guide to Norse mythology. I mean, you could go straight to the poetic or the prose edda, but that's a bit of a more difficult route through it.
Yeah, as someone who has had to go through these, get yourself a good translation if you can, because some of them are very dry. But yeah, that's a possibility. Then, you know, there's obviously also the Nibelungenlied from Germany, which is, you know, in that whole Germanic pantheon of gods, does have similar heroes. So Sigurd from the Norse myth is Siegfried. And you've got the Wagner opera as well that is sort of based around that, you know, that version of these myths. But that's more about the heroes than the gods.
Yeah. There you go. Thanks very much, Lucy and Janina, for a fascinating discussion there about Norse mythology. If anyone wants to find out more about you two, how can we go about it?
So we're Fae Fellows Podcast on Facebook, Instagram and Tumblr. And you will find us on Twitter as Fae Fellows.
Fantastic. And Janina and Lucy will be back in next time for a discussion about more of the folklore that populates the world from all different corners of the earth. There's some really fascinating stories to discuss. So please stick around for next episode. Thank you very much again, Janina and Lucy. Thank you so much to Lucy and Janina for a fascinating chat about Norse mythology. And thank you to you too for listening today. I hope you found it useful and maybe you learned something new. If you've got any questions or comments, please don't hesitate to email at thefantasywriterstoolshed@gmail.com or join our writing community. The link is in the description. And it would mean an awful, awful lot if you subscribed, followed, shared, or even just left a quick review of this podcast. And if you'd like to get some cool things like my book on writing fantasy, A Fantasy Writer's Handbook, and access to all my fantasy writing courses, check out our Patreon page. Again, the link for that is in the description. We're back on the 28th of November with a look at day-to-day life in the medieval period, and a look at magic and science, and a thorn in the foot of every writer, getting book reviews. So until then, thanks for listening and happy scribbling.